From Florida to Washington, Pennsylvania to New Mexico, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Trump took office, pledging to cut two federal regulations for every one new regulation. Has he kept that promise? Bill Kirpin of American Commitment is here with the answer. A predicted Democratic blue wave failed to materialize in last week's Texas primary. Andy Roth of the Club for Growth has the real story on what happened in the Lone Star State. President Trump is placing tariffs on imported steel. It will save American jobs, but is it the best way to do so? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Dan Eikenson of the Cato Institute. And speaking of those tariffs, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains why they are an important element of national security on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Obama administration imposed a massive amount of new regulation on just about every sector of the American economy. President Trump has vowed to provide regulatory relief. For a progress report on how that's coming along, we talk with Phil Kirpin, who is president of American Commitment. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, President Trump has had just a little over a year in office. One of his main goals was to cut regulation, especially regulation that was stifling business growth. So looking back over the first year, has much progress been made?
Yeah, it's really been a pretty incredible year in terms of what's happened on deregulation. Almost every significant expensive Obama regulation from 8 years has either been repealed or is in the process of being revised or repealed already after just a year of the Trump administration. And so sort of the big, sort of infamous centerpiece regulations, things like the EPA, Waters of the United States rule, and the greenhouse gas rules, the FCC's internet regulations, some of the department of various Department of Labor rules on all kinds of things, from the fiduciary rule on financial advisors to various employment rules and so forth. And basically everything that we were so angry about that the Obama administration sort of did in circumvention of Congress with the pen and the phone and all of that sort of thing has either already been reversed or is in the process of being reversed. And sort of numerically, President Trump came in and said, for every one new regulation that's put in, I want you to get rid of two old regulations. Well, in the first year, he over-delivered by a lot. It was more like 22 old regulations were removed for every one new regulation. So it sort of over-delivered on deregulation by a factor of 10. And Loman, one of the stats that I saw recently that I just found unbelievable is that for calendar year 2017, 81% of regulatory costs imposed on the U.S. economy were imposed in the first 3 weeks of the year when Obama was still president, which I think is a pretty telling stat in terms of the change of the regulatory environment that took place when President Trump took the oath of office.
Of course, the area where regulations were ramped up most heavily during the Obama administration was on health care. And although there was a failure to totally repeal and replace Obamacare, have we also, Phil, seen a significant decrease in the number of regulations on the health care industry?
There are several major deregulatory efforts related to healthcare that are ongoing right now. None of them have reached the final rule stage, but there are proposed rules from the Department of Labor that make association health plans much more widely available. And when that rule is finalized, we can expect to see a lot of additional healthcare options made available to people through various types of associations, both across states and within states. There is an HHS proposed rule that just came out a couple of weeks ago that's now open for public comment that deregulates something called short-term limited duration insurance that was becoming a very popular alternative to Obamacare. And the Obama administration essentially crippled through a 2016 regulation that said those policies could only be 3 months long instead of 12 months. So the Trump administration wants to go back to allowing short-term policies to be up to 12 months. And we're expecting a Treasury IRS rulemaking that will deregulate health reimbursement arrangements, whereby employers reimburse people for their own health expenditures, which was something that used to be pretty popular, that was also killed by the Obama administration. And so there are a lot of major deregulatory efforts underway related to healthcare. None of them have quite been finalized yet, but there's a lot in the pipeline, and that was sort of kicked off by an executive order the president signed back in October.
So more to come on that front. Now, The success of the past year, the legislative success, was the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. However, Phil, unfortunately, the one component of that that didn't quite get us where we wanted to be is that the individual tax cuts are set to expire in 2025. Are we looking for an effort this year to make those tax cuts permanent?
Yes, and I believe that at a minimum the House is going to vote on making them permanent, which I think will be a very useful vote for the American people to see, and I hope will put enough pressure on the Senate that'll lead to a Senate vote as well. In any event, it'll be helpful, I think, for voters to see where every member of the House stands on that, and I hope that we'll see a Senate vote as well. Democrats have sort of leaned on this very heavily as a political talking point, saying, well, you know, yeah, your taxes went down, but that's all going to go away in 8 years. The problem with that for them, the reason I don't think that quite works as a political talking point for Democrats, is they're the reason that that expiration is in there. Republicans would have been happy to make all of it permanent, but because the Democratic filibuster in the Senate forced them to use a budget reconciliation process to pass the bill, Senate procedural rules required it not to have a deficit impact outside of the 10-year budget window, and that's what led to them including that expiration. And of course, it's unlikely that these tax cuts will ever expire, at least for most people. Remember, the Bush tax cuts were all set to expire in 2010, and even with Obama in the White House, I believe they were made permanent for everyone under $400,000 of income. And so people at the very top didn't get permanent tax cuts out of the Bush tax cuts, but pretty much everyone else did, even with a Democratic president. And so it's likely that these will eventually be extended anyway, but it would be very smart for Republicans to go ahead and do it right now so that this possibility isn't hanging out there and people don't have uncertainty about whether these provisions are actually going to expire. And also, I think it's a very tough vote for Democrats, because if they've been out there saying I was against the tax cut bill because I didn't like the expirations, and then you put a bill in front of them to make all the tax cuts permanent, do they vote for it and sort of admit that the tax cuts were a good idea that should now be made permanent, contrary to what they previously said, or do they vote against it and then sort of no longer really have the credibility to say that they were against the tax cuts because they were temporary? And so I think it's a very smart vote to have. I've been told that House leadership is committed to doing it this year, and I would hope the Senate would as well.
As you mentioned, President Trump has very rapidly undone many of the regulations, if not most of the regulations, put into effect by President Obama by executive order. So going forward, Phil, how do we keep all these regulation cuts from being undone by new regulations when a new president comes in?
Well, we strongly support a bill called the RAINS Act, the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act. It's already passed the House, and it's passed the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee in the Senate. It's never had a Senate floor vote. And I would love to see this bill rolled together with making the tax cuts permanent under the banner of making all of the advances on economic policy of the past year permanent.
We have been talking with Phil Kirpin, who is president of American Commitment. Phil, a couple of words about American Commitment and where folks can go on the web to read more about your organization.
We are a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all of the fiscal, economic, regulatory issues. But what we do that's different from some of the other Washington groups is we do not do original research. We don't ask you to read 20 and 30 page white papers. We try to get facts and information on what's on the margin, where you can actually make a difference with things moving in Congress or through regulatory agencies. And all our stuff, Loman, is on the web at AmericanCommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being back with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
Andy Roth is at the Club for Growth, and we have the 2018 primary season now underway with one of the biggest primaries of all in the state of Texas. Andy, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
As we have done for many years, we are going to go state by state as primaries are being held and talk about what occurred in those states. So Texas had its primary, and Andy, leading up to the primary, there was all sorts of left-wing bravado about how a blue wave was going to go over Texas, and Ted Cruz was going to be in trouble, and Democrats were going to outperform Republicans. Seems like the waters were a bit still.
Yeah, God bless Texas. It really turned out to be a great night for conservatives. And since these are primaries and the Democrats are fighting the Democrats and the Republicans are fighting the Republicans, there wasn't a lot of evidence that Democrats were somehow picking the best candidates and that they're ready to rock and roll in November. In fact, we didn't see much of that at all. Regarding Ted Cruz's race, he obviously won his primary running away with it. But his opponent, Beto O'Rourke, who represents El Paso, way out by New Mexico, he was considered the Democrats' darling, and he underperformed quite a bit in his primary. He won with 67%, which may sound good, but everybody was expecting him to just knock the socks off of his opponents, and he wasn't able to do that. So Cruz was always considered to be in good shape in the general in November, but this confirms that it's probably not going to be a race at all and that he's just going to be fine.
We had a number of very hotly contested races for nominations to run for Congress in November. Texas being a runoff state, we're now going to proceed in several districts into runoff. So why don't we talk about three or four of those, Andy, and let's start out in Texas District 2.
Texas is a fun state to watch if you're a political junkie just because of the runoff. What happens is a lot of candidates run in the primary. None of them get over 50%, which allows them to win outright. So the top two vote-getters then advance to a runoff. In Texas, too, there was a candidate named Kathleen Wall who spent $6 million of her own money in this race, and everybody presumed that she was going to either avoid a runoff by getting over 50%, or she would just get really close and be the front runner in the runoff. It turns out that her $6 million didn't get her anything. She ended up getting third place. So the runoff is going to have a former Navy SEAL. His name's Dan Crenshaw versus, I don't think he's a lawyer, but he runs a law firm, Kevin Roberts. And as best as we can tell, this is a nice conservative versus establishment race, with Crenshaw being the conservative and Roberts being the establishment. So it was an interesting race, needless to say.
These conservative versus establishment runoffs are now presenting themselves in a number of districts, including Texas 6.
Yeah, that's right. Ron Wright is the leading candidate. He got 45% in the primary. He almost got 50. But unfortunately, he's going to be forced into a runoff with a gentleman named Jake Elzey, who is very anti-Ted Cruz. In fact, when Cruz was running for president, Elzey would stalk his two strong of a term, but he would follow Cruz everywhere on the campaign trail and just badger and heckle him. He was able to get enough votes to squeak into the runoff. So I think Ron Wright is going to win that easily. He said that he's going to join the House Freedom Caucus, and it will be fun to have him up here once he wins. And full disclosure, the Club for Growth PAC has endorsed him.
And in Texas 5.
Texas 5, Jeb Hensarling, Congressman Jeb Hensarling, is retiring. He's an absolute rock star, so it's important to replace him with another rock star. Bunny Pounds, that's her real name, she is running. She is a political consultant, which sounds bad, but basically she raises money for conservatives. And she looked at this race and didn't see any conservatives in it, so she decided to run herself. She is going to be a future House Freedom Caucus member. She is running against Lance Gooden, who is a state rep in Texas. He is very much with the teachers union. He's anti-school choice. He's raised taxes and fees. He is every bit a liberal Republican. So this is, like I said before, this is a very much a conservative versus liberal runoff that we're seeing all across Texas.
Wow, there is quite a stark difference in that race,
yeah, right.
to say the least. And now let's jump ahead to Texas 21.
Texas 21, this is probably my favorite race. And let me mention, the Club for Growth PAC endorsed Bunny Pounds in that 5th district. The Club for Growth PAC has also endorsed Chip Roy in the 21st district. Chip is just, he's going to be, I hope, a nationwide or a household name among the conservative base nationwide once he wins. He was chief of staff to Ted Cruz when Cruz was first elected in 2012. Chip has been in the conservative movement for a long time before and after that. He decided that he wanted to run for this seat, and he got first place in the primary, and now he's going to run against Matt McCall. McCall is not what people would characterize as a liberal Republican, but he just doesn't have the necessary resources and support to really get over the finish line. So while this may not be a good versus evil race, it definitely looks really good for Chip to win. And once he wins, he's going to hit the ground running in Congress, and we just can't wait to see that happen.
When will the runoff be held, Andy?
It's over 2 months from now. It's going to be May 22nd. That's a little unusual. Some runoffs across the country, like in South Carolina, are only 2 weeks after the primary. And then other places, it's just 1 month. But here, it's over 2 months. So we've got a long runway with which to continue to campaign on.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, a couple of words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization, but we have over 250,000 members from all across the country, from all walks of life, from all 50 states in the union, and we're united because we believe in economic freedom. If your listeners are interested, they can go to our website at www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free.
Andy Roth at the Club for Growth. Andy, we'll check in with you again next week.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
New tariffs on imported steel have rocked the markets and triggered a nationwide debate on their impact. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine sorts through the issue with Don Eikenson of the Cato Institute. Eric?
So the big news out of the White House this week was the announcement that President Donald Trump is imposing big tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. All of this supposed to protect important domestic manufacturing jobs, and the Trump administration is saying it's ultimately about national security, but there's also the potential that these tariffs could do serious damage to America's economy. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Dan Eikenson. He is the Director of Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and he joins us on the phone now. Dan, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So, Dan, let's get right into it. These tariffs, potentially 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. We don't yet have all the details of exactly how this will work or whether there might be some exemptions. You know, there's still some details to fill in here. But generally speaking, this is something that could seriously impact the economy in a lot of different ways.
This is true. We're talking about tariffs of 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. Tariffs are just taxes. If you think about these products, they are raw materials that are consumed by a lot of U.S. industries in their own production processes. So the initial tariff is going to get magnified through the supply chain all the way down to the final end user. And what's really troubling about it is, I mean, the math is pretty simple. For every one worker in the steel industry, there are 47 workers in the downstream industries that consume steel. And for every dollar towards GDP, represented by the steel producers, there are $29 toward GDP for the steel using industries. In other words, the steel using industries are 29 times more important to our economy than the steel producers are. And so there are clearly going to be costs. Politicians tend to want to get away with these things because the costs are diffuse. They're dispersed across a broader economy. But the costs will still be there, and they could have calamitous consequences for these companies who need to compete against other downstream industries from abroad in selling appliances and cars and pipes and tubes and things like that. And then there's also U.S. companies that are going to experience retaliation from foreign governments. And so the costs can't even begin to be added up at the moment, but they will be significant.
Yeah, the costs here will be borne by lots of different people and businesses, consumers, just about everybody. That's why you see that big drop in the stock market after Trump announced these tariffs, and another big drop this week when the White House officially signed them. I mean, that's a big deal. Then you've got those very specific benefits like you talked about, and I just think about the CEO of U.S. Steel yesterday going on TV and talking about how grateful he was that the Trump administration was imposing these tariffs, because, of course, he's going to benefit from them. His industry will benefit from them at the expense of everyone else. Dan, I want to get into something else that you mentioned there, which is that this could spark some sort of a trade war. We hear that phrase thrown around quite a bit. What does that mean, and are you worried that we're actually heading that way?
I am worried, and governments don't want to retaliate because retaliation represents a cost to their citizens and their businesses. So the way the Europeans have sort of structured their retaliation list is strategic in the sense that they're identifying U.S. export interests that are prominent in the states of powerful members of Congress. So, bourbon from Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, cheese, motorcycles from Wisconsin, Paul Ryan. But if you're not strategic about retaliation and you want to be vindictive, then this could really get out of hand, and governments can continue to ratchet things up. I can see the Chinese government, which considers its dependence on foreign technology, on foreign semiconductors, to be a national security threat to them. I could see them justifying the actions they have taken over the past many years to force technology transfer and force Western companies to share their source code. Right now they're on the defensive. There's a U.S. case under Section 301 that's trying to get the Chinese to change their ways. Now they'll just say, well, you know what, we're doing this because it's a national security imperative. So it's the benchmark has been lowered considerably for these pretenses for protection.
We're talking with Dan Eikenson from the Cato Institute about the announcement this week from the White House of new tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. Dan, I do want to push back just a bit here because I'm from Pennsylvania. A big part of that state was built on the back of the steel industry. So that industry is in a bit of trouble right now. The jobs have been declining and going away. If I'm an out-of-work steel worker in Pennsylvania or Kentucky or Illinois, wherever, maybe I'm pretty excited about Trump's tariffs because I think that might mean my job is coming back or more jobs are coming back to the American steel industry. Isn't that a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe there will be a few jobs supported or a few jobs that the termination of which will be deferred, you know, a year or two. The fact of the matter is, and the story of steel is no different than the story of manufacturing overall, doing well economically, it's just that they don't support as many jobs as they used to. You know, manufacturing employment peaked out in 1979 at 19.4 million workers, and it's been trending downward ever since. Similar trend in the steel industry, and that's because of productivity gains. You know, it used to take 10 guys working on the line to produce a ton of steel in an hour, and now it's 1.5 people and a machine. And so that is the objective of economics is to overcome scarcity and to produce more with less. We're succeeding there. What these steel workers who are trying to hold onto their jobs should be doing and what policymakers in their states should be doing is creating opportunities for them, overcoming labor market friction so that there are other places where they can work. There's not as much labor demand in these industries anymore.
Yeah, try as they might. You can't bring back the old days with legislation or with tariffs. You can't do it with government at all. Really, all you can do is prepare for what's coming next. You can, however, with government, do a lot of damage to the economy, and that seems to be the direction we are going. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. Dan Eikenson from the Cato Institute, thanks for joining us.
Take care.
And again, that is Dan Eikenson. He is the Director of Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. You can check out his work at cato.org. You can head over to reason.com to check out our coverage of Trump's tariff announcement and take a look at what Congress could do to potentially put the brakes on Trump's tariffs. All of that at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. We'll catch you right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Colin Hanna of Lead Freedom Ring USA thinks President Trump is right to impose tariffs on foreign steel imports. He explains why on this American Radio Journal commentary.
President Donald Trump is nothing if not orthodox, so no one should be surprised when he proposes something as unorthodox as tariffs that fly in the face of the orthodoxy of free trade, as he is now proposing for steel and aluminum. In this case, I think he's right. The holy grail of free trade is the combination of lower prices for American consumers and bigger markets for American exporters. The goal within the grail is to have something close to a dollar balance between imports and exports. When this country made more stuff than any other nation, lowering tariff barriers to entering other countries' markets was almost always in America's interest because American manufactured goods were generally of higher quality and lower price than the domestically produced products of smaller nations. We had economies of scale from serving the world's largest market, and in many cases the most advanced technologies could be found in American products. Importing products that are highly labor-dependent from low-wage countries results in lower prices for those goods for American consumers. Some of the underlying assumptions of free trade for the past 100 years or so are no longer the case, however. Many American-manufactured products no longer have the technological edge and are often more expensive. Opening new markets to American manufacturers is no longer a virtual guarantee of more export sales. So, exports are reduced, and we are left with a trade deficit. There are only two ways to address a trade deficit: export more or import less. Currency manipulations can affect the balance, but the principle remains the same: export more in dollar value than we import. But there's another factor that is typically ignored in a purely economic analysis, and it's what I call strategic significance. Certain capabilities are essential to maintaining the largest military power on Earth. Steel, aluminum, aircraft manufacturing, and certain electronics such as chip manufacturing. To make this point, let's construct a scenario in which another nation wants to weaken our military might so that they can obtain a global strategic advantage over us. If they could undermine our capacity to make ships and aircraft, we would become dependent on other nations for ships and aircraft. If they could hide some stealth circuitry in computer chips in our military equipment and power grid that could be switched on to cause havoc, our very viability as a nation would be threatened. If they undermined our strategically significant industries with artificially lower prices, they'd weaken our industries even faster. Isn't that what's happening now, especially with regard to Chinese steel? Not all industries are of similar strategic significance. We're probably better off with low-priced apparel, for example, even if certain domestic apparel makers are driven out of business. The loss of our shoemaking, furniture, and even consumer electronics industries aren't of such strategic significance that we'd be crippled as a free state without them. Dependence on potentially unfriendly nations for oil has already demonstrated how easily we can become vulnerable. And indeed, energy would make my short list of strategically significant industries, but for the time being, we're much less dependent on foreign suppliers. So steel and aluminum are legitimate candidates for protective tariffs based on their strategic significance, even if there is an offsetting higher economic cost. Furthermore, the leverage that threatening tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from our neighbors and largest trading partners, Canada and Mexico, gives this administration, as the president might say, huge leverage as he attempts to renegotiate the NAFTA trade agreement. Finally, there is a connection between trade and jobs that many free trade advocates try to deny. Famed Reaganite economist Art Laffer is one of the most vocal and forceful in denying this connection. Here are three of his unambiguous statements on the subject. 1. Free trade is the answer. 2. Protectionism is a big, big mistake. 3. There is no connection between trade and jobs. None. Well, the 500 workers whom U.S. Steel has said this week that they would hire back don't believe that, nor do I. The president may not be an economist, and he may have just suffered the resignation of his chief economic advisor over this very issue. But economists are often wrong. As Harry Truman famously said, if you lined up all the economists end to end, they'd still find a way to point in different directions. There's a reason that theirs is sometimes called the dismal science. They may be right that protective tariffs are economically inefficient, but in the case of steel and aluminum, there's a Trump factor and its strategic significance. The president is right on this one. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KYND-AM, in Belleville, Texas. Welcome to our new listeners in the Lone Star State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on our program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.